This is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, October 5th, 2014, and this is show number 491. Well, I am really excited about Chit-Chat Across the Pond this week. We have Rene Ritchie from iMore. He was positively delightful. Every single minute, he's informative, he's smart, he's funny. Love talking to him. I hope we get him back on the show again. But that's just a teaser for Chit-Chat Across the Pond, so let's get started here. I did want to take a quick minute to thank everyone who uses my Amazon affiliate link to buy their toys. I get a report every month that's about 3 months in arrears that tells me how much money you guys are spending by going through podfeet.com to get to Amazon. Would you believe you guys are spending around $2,000 a month? That's crazy, and I love it. Now, I don't get $2,000 a month, obviously. I get a tiny percentage of that. But if you don't know what I'm talking about, if you use the little Amazon search window over at podfeet.com on the left sidebar, anything you buy after that search sends a small percentage to help the show. I also, whenever I talk about something that's on Amazon, I embed an image of it. If you buy it through that link, that also gives credit to the show. And I got to tell you, it really adds up. You know, a pack of paper towels at a time, I get a little percentage there. Someone told me that they made a bookmark called Amazon, but it's actually to podfeet.com, so they remember to use the affiliate link. So you could consider that as well. Anyway, I just want to thank you guys for remembering the show and helping in a way that doesn't cost you a dime. Well, we've got a little listener comment here. Let's go ahead and plug this right in.
Hello, Allison, and this is the Castaways. I'm Jonathan Quinlan with a review of Guided Access in the Accessibility menu on iOS. Starting with a problem to be solved. When I'm travelling in the car with younger family members, they always bug me to play games on my iPad, which is fine as it keeps them quiet whilst I'm driving. However, I have a large amount of my A-level IT and programming coursework on my iPad, which I'm constantly worried about accidentally being deleted by younger family members. Also, I don't mind them playing games for an hour and using some of my battery, however I don't want it to be completely dead when I may need to use it. So I recently came across Guided Access in Accessibility, which until last week I didn't even know existed. This solves my problem, as you can lock the iPad into one application or game, which can't be closed without entering a password, as well as the fact that I can set a time limit which prevents my iPad from being completely drained. This solves my problem, and I hope that it helps someone else who hasn't noticed it's there yet.
Well, this is really cool, Jonathan. I never would have thought of using Guided Access for this reason. You know, I knew it was there, but I pictured only for like professional displays or something like museum tours where you don't want people to go outside of a certain set of menus. I never thought of it to manage children and battery life. I threw a couple of links and a couple of screenshots into the show notes so people can see where this is and some of the options you can set. I have to say, this is the most succinct review I think we have ever had. We've talked before about the importance of using a password manager, you know, in this age of constantly hacked services. There's no perfect solution yet, but we've been able to prove time and time again that letting a human pick passwords is pretty much the most flawed approach you can take. We can't remember passwords, and we can't even invent random ones, so we fail basically from every direction. We cannot be trusted. If you use a password manager, you can choose to have it create random passwords your brain would never think of and which you can never type. We've also talked about using Bart's awesome XKPassWD tool to generate random and yet typable passwords. Now, I'm betting that many of you are in the camp of, yeah, I know I should use a password manager. I'm really, really going to get around to that soon. Sort of like, remember in the old days when we all knew we should be doing backups, but it was just so hard, we didn't start doing them until it got as easy as plugging in a backup drive and Time Machine saying, hey, want a backup? Now, we really are at the point where there's no really good excuse to not use a password manager like LastPass or 1Password. Now, you may recall that I've been a LastPass user for a few years, but I've been frustrated because they've never been able to permanently fix the problem I have that it stops logging me out when I'm idle, when I stop using LastPass. And it turns out that was enough to push me to try 1Password. Now that I've used both for a while, I'd like to walk you through each one and give you some pros and cons that maybe would help you make your own decision. And remember, they are both great services, and you will not go wrong either way. The only way you can go wrong is if you don't use a password manager. Seriously. Now, I remember when Dorothy was trying to decide, and she made this big pro-con chart for herself of the two services, and in the end, she said she flipped a coin because they were both equally good. So they are both really good, and I don't want to necessarily sway you, but I want to tell you how I made the decision. In her case, she ended up choosing 1Password, and so did Bart. So you might not want to listen to the rest of what I say and just go get 1Password, but you might want to also listen. I want to tell you up front, 1Password is available from agilebits.com and LastPass is available from lastpass.com. So let's dig into each of them, pros and cons. I'm going to start with LastPass. The first thing to realize about LastPass is that it's free for web access. So you go to the LastPass.com website, you log in, and there's all your passwords. So you can get that right away, and it's absolutely free. It doesn't cost you a dime. Now, if you want to spend a little bit of money, they have mobile apps, which are cross-platform for premium subscribers. And that's only going to cost you $12 a year, so it's still really inexpensive. And they have clients for iOS, Android, Windows Phone, and even BlackBerry. Now, with the web access, you can also use the, extensions for your browsers. So you don't have to log into the website each time, but you log into this little extension. That's the piece that I have trouble with, but it has worked for most people. The other thing to know about LastPass that really is a feather in their cap is it was vetted by Steve Gibson, the guy who runs GRC.com. He's a noted security expert, and he was able to look at the source code and confirmed that they cannot possibly unlock your vault. So even though they store it on their servers, they can't unlock it. One of the things I really liked about LastPass was you can share passwords with a trusted person, and they get updates when you change them if you set it up correctly. So Steve and I, for example, will make sure that we have access to each other's bank accounts. We give each other the password in a way that if I change it on my end, it actually changes it on his end, so it propagates through the two vaults. And that works really well for us. They also have a new feature, I don't think I've even tested this yet, called the Family Share Folder. So you create a folder for the family to share, and then everybody's vault gets to see what's ever in that family share. So that's kind of a cool way of doing it. I already mentioned that you use browser extensions for all the major browsers. And again, at that point, you're still free if you do it that way. Now, on the computer, you only do get the website and browser extensions. You don't get any kind of menu bar app. You don't have a standalone application. So you can only access it through a web browser. They have a fabulous service where you can audit your passwords. Now, I highly recommend doing it, but I highly recommend you not kill yourself when you realize how bad you are at doing your passwords. So it's a great service to go through, but it's kind of depressing because then you realize how much you really needed this. Now, LastPass was very helpful during Heartbleed. It told you which sites you need to go update your password on and which ones where you should probably just wait because they haven't patched it yet anyway. Now, their password manager, they store it encrypted locally and on the LastPass services. The LastPass servers. So storing your very, very most private passwords on someone else's server is a little bit scary. You need to decide, is that a good or a bad thing if they're storing it for you? Now, back to what I had trouble with. My biggest problem was in the extension, you can set it to how long to wait till it logs you out. So I set mine to 15 minutes because I'm on a laptop, for crying out loud. I don't want to go on travel and be logged into all of my passwords. That would be really dumb. That would defeat the purpose of all this, right? Well, mine stopped logging me out, and I don't know why. They couldn't figure it out. We did a bunch of stuff. It fixed it for a couple weeks. It came back. They fixed it again for a couple weeks. It came back. I wasn't really happy either with their customer service. The lag was maybe 2 or 3 days every time they got back to me. And, you know, that's a long time when I am a premium subscriber. I mean, I know I'm only paying $12 a year, but I am paying for this service. So that was kind of a problem for me, and that really was what I had to go away from it. I did like the service, and I loved working on it with Steve, but I got to be secure. That's the whole point. The interface on LastPass is acceptable, but it's not super pretty. I mean, it's functional, but a little bit open source feely for me. It's not as pretty as what you're going to find over in 1Password. Now, it feels to me like it's more steps to enter a password than on 1Password. I don't know that it is, because I tried finding a place where I could prove it, but I couldn't prove it. Every place I went to, it was either the same or even faster with LastPass. But I don't know. It just feels smoother with 1Password to me. And let's see. Like I said, it was, as I already mentioned, customer service was slow. Here's another thing. LastPass works with Touch ID on the iPhone 5S and 6, but only in Safari. So inside Safari, you can tap on the little share sheet button, which is a square with the arrow up out of it, like if you want to share to an email or a text message. From within there, you can say, I want to talk to LastPass. You can use your Touch ID, and it'll connect in, and it'll find the right password, and it'll plug it in for you. But you can't open the mobile app itself with just your Touch ID. So let's say you've got an app for your bank, for example. You can't use your thumb to get into LastPass and get that password and then paste it into that app. And if your bank hasn't written the extension to allow LastPass to talk to it yet, then you can't do it at all. So you're going to have to type that long, complicated password still, even though you've got Touch ID enabled. Now, I thought maybe I was wrong, but I actually found a blog post by the LastPass people that says, yeah, it doesn't do that. So you can't open your vault and look at your passwords and everything with your thumbprint. So keep that in mind. Now, let's flip over to 1Password and see how 1Password from AgileBits works. First of all, it's a lot more expensive. A single-user, single-platform license costs $50. It's a lot of money. If you go cross-platform, Windows and Mac, you can get a single-user for $70. And the family pack is actually a really good deal. 5 family members, I think this is just Windows or Mac, one or the other, is $70. So that's actually the deal I went with. Now, you might like a one-time purchase better than a monthly fee. I'm a big fan of I want to buy what I own, and I don't want to have all these monthly fees because everything's a monthly fee now, and it's really getting on my nerves. But 1Password is traditionally charged upgrade fees for major point releases, so no matter how you do the math, it's definitely going to be more expensive than the $12 a year for LastPass, unless you choose not to upgrade to the newer versions, which kind of misses out on some really good functionality, because they do build lots of really cool things into each major point release. Now, I should say that those upgrades are pretty affordable. Mine was only $20 to go from a single user to a family pack along with an upgrade. So they do have good prices on that. But you got to realize, you're paying for a really nice tool here. You got to decide whether it's worth it to you. Now, their new thing they've done with iOS 8 is their iOS 8 app is free. And with that, you get logins, credit cards, identities, and secure notes. For $10 for the premium option on that same application, you can also get access to things like your software license keys, information about your wireless routers that you stored, and you can organize within the 1Password tool. You can organize with folders and tags, access multiple vaults, view attachments, and create custom fields. So it's kind of nice because you get the most important thing, which is the logins, for free. So that's kind of a nice little bonus thing. Now, the 1Password is available for iOS and Android mobile apps for mobile phones, but there's no Windows Phone app, unfortunately. 1Password comes as a standalone application on your Mac or PC. On your Mac, it's also a menu bar app, and they have the same kind of browser extensions as you do over on LastPass. It's nice to have all three ways of accessing and organizing the content. I really find that all three have their own place. Now, 1Password wins in being very, very pretty. Now, pretty isn't always the most important thing, but it is important if it increases usability. For example, for application serial numbers, it searches for the icon for the app. So if you're searching for an app, you know how sometimes the icon is what jumps out at you? That's what makes you realize that, that's my GarageBand icon or whatever. It really does help you find things in the list of applications easier because it goes out to your desktop, finds the icon file, the ICNS file, and actually imports it into 1Password so you can see it. Really, really helps. They do the same thing with credit cards. So if you put in a Visa, for example, it'll put in the Visa logo. So you can actually, I think it helps a little bit in finding them. I know in a lot of tools, I'm sitting there going, oh man, is that my Visa or my MasterCard? I can't remember, but it'll actually show it to you in 1Password. They also do some little animations that just make me happy. It's not important and it doesn't make it more useful, but maybe that's one of the things that makes me think it's going faster than it actually is. Here's a really, really important thing. It works with Touch ID beautifully, both in Safari and to open your vault. Now, this is critical. Like I said, when you need to lock into an app, like your banking app, you go to your banking app, you flip over to 1Password, it is 1Password. Yes, got to keep these straight. You flip over to 1Password, tap your thumb down, there's your password, boom, copy, double click, paste, you're done. This functionality works so well, I'm pretty sure I'm going to upgrade to the new iPad, even though I have an iPad Air. I normally don't get the new one every year. I'm probably going to do it just to get that Touch ID because it drives me nuts. And on my iPad, I'm like, ugh, I got to type in a password. That's so annoying. I mean, I've only had it for 10 minutes and I can't live without it. Can't live without it. Absolutely. Other thing is that AgileBits is a really good company for technical support. Now, you are paying more for the service, and you expect more, but you actually get more. They have quick response. The people are intelligent. They have good answers. I mean, they really get back to me quickly. I was a little bit worried because I know that my friend Nick works there, and he's often the one who helps me. But I have heard from other people that this is standard operating procedure with AgileBits. I've seen lots and lots and lots of people talk about how great their customer service is. So I don't think it's just because they happen to know who I am. Now, we talked over in LastPass about how they store your vault on their servers. 1Password doesn't work that way. AgileBits does not store it. You have to choose if you want to be able to use your passwords between your Mac and your iPhone and your iPad and your Android phone. If you want all that data going back and forth, you have to put it on a server someplace, and AgileBits does not store it. You have to choose between iCloud and Dropbox to sync the vaults between devices. I've chosen Dropbox, and it works beautifully. But remember, of course, it is stored encrypted, and they still can't get to it, just like it was true on the other one. But, you know, good or bad, you decide. Do you trust iCloud or Dropbox, or do you only trust LastPass? Which way do you want to go? So if you do trust iCloud or Dropbox, then 1Password could work for you. Now, this is another thing I didn't know about, but Dorothy told me about this afternoon. You can get access to your passwords from any computer at any time. If you do your syncing through Dropbox, you can log into your Dropbox account on the web from this strange computer. So you can go to, well, probably wouldn't do it on a strange computer, but you can go to Dropbox.com and log in. And hopefully you remember your Dropbox login. That is the one tricky bit. But from there, you can navigate to your 1Password keychain file. You can actually see it in Dropbox. And within there, there's an HTML file. If you click on that, you'll be prompted for your 1Password credentials. And now you have full access to your 1Password database. It looks a lot like the real program. So it's actually a fourth way to look at your data. I noticed in 1Password, I was curious whether they would do the security audit like LastPass did, which I was really, really happy about. Turns out they give you a bunch of different ways to look at the security of your passwords. The first one is called Watchtower, and it checks websites for vulnerabilities. So if you have a password that hasn't been updated in the length of time since some vulnerability has come, it'll tell you. I found out that IFTTT had a vulnerability since the last time I changed my password, so I was able to go over to IFTTT, change my password, and it auto-filled it back in. And what I really liked it about the way 1Password did it was when I fixed it over on 1Password, it actually now just disappeared from Watchtower. So IFTTT was there. As soon as I fixed the password and saved, it went boom, and it disappeared. So it's real-time updating, which really, really worked well. You can also check for weak passwords. I found a few that weren't real anymore. They were to strange things that don't actually exist, so I was able to delete these. But I found a few where I still had a really stupid password, and I was able to go in and fix them. And like I said, again, they just disappeared immediately from the list as soon as I fixed them. So I really felt like I was making some progress instead of having to go back and refresh a big old annoying web page, which is kind of the way LastPass does it. It can also check for duplicate passwords, and I think it's a little bit smarter. LastPass keeps yelling at me for the fact that my iTunes password and my Apple ID have the same username and password. Well, of course they do, because they are the same thing, but because it's going to a different site, sort of, it thinks they're two separate passwords, and it's always yelling at me. 1Password didn't give me that annoying complaint, so that was cool. They will also check passwords by age, so they've got a bunch of different segments, like these passwords haven't been changed in the last 3 years. I went through and I was able to clean up a ton of passwords in a really short amount of time, and I really felt good about it. It was really fun. So, the bottom line is, what's important for you and what's important for me as we each make our own choices? 1Password for me is now the clear winner. The better technical support, better Touch ID support, nicer user interface, all of that is really worth the money for me. And of course, the primary thing is, it actually logs me out when I'm idle for 15 minutes, unlike LastPass. If you use the LastPass, go check that. Make sure it's really working. If money, however, is your primary concern, LastPass is an excellent choice, as long as it logs you out properly when you're idle. If that stops working for you like it did me, I'd cut something else out of my budget so I could afford to go get 1Password. If you've been a LastPass user and my discussion has convinced you to jump ship to 1Password, there's a really useful script that you're going to need. This script takes the export of your LastPass data, and it converts the data so that it'll slide nicely into your new shiny 1Password vault into the right fields. If you don't use the script, you will be missing a lot of data that you'll have to replicate or move things around. Without it, my 125 software license files did not come over properly. I should mention that this script, though, is written by a 1Password evangelist, not vetted by AgileBits. But I did have Bart take a look at the script, and he said that it does not send your passwords to China or the NSA. I put a link in the show notes to the script so you could go check it out for yourself. I want to do a quick intermission for a public service announcement. My daughter, Lindsay, is getting married on October 18th, which is about 2 weeks from now. And so Bart is going to be running the show for that weekend. As always, he would really, really, really appreciate if you would send in audio reviews, comments, suggestions, dumb questions, whatever you can do to help him create content for that show. You can send it to me or, most people know how to get a hold of Bart, but send it to me if you don't have his address over at allison@podfeet.com. So in the next, week and a half, it'd be great if you could get something to him. That would be absolutely wonderful. Help him out. Help him create a great show for you. I've been given flack in the past for my belief that an engineering degree gives you an advantage in the tech space, but I'm going to say it again anyway, even if I do get hate mail about it. First of all, before you write your hate mail, I do believe it's possible to gain the tools necessary to be quite good in the field without an engineering degree, and many people do gain that ability. However, I still believe that because engineering schools pound into the students certain ways of looking at things, especially around how to do a controlled experiment, engineers get a big leg up on diagnosing problems. So why am I bringing this up again, if not just to get hate mail? Well, this week, Steve and I solved an interesting problem, and I thought it was kind of fun how we solved it. A couple of years ago, we switched from Time Warner Cable over to Verizon Fios. I had no problems with Time Warner. They just didn't offer the speeds of Fios. About 6 months ago, I noticed a problem with our connectivity. We lose internet connection whenever the phone rings. Now, this wouldn't be an issue for normal people. You probably wouldn't even notice it. But if you're on a Skype call and the phone rings, you're gone. Not exactly what a podcaster is looking for. Luckily, it never happened when I was on anyone else's show, but a few times when Bart and I have been chatting, I've lost him for a brief while, maybe 10 or 15 seconds while my internet took a coffee break. I should point out that Skype very gracefully recovers when this happens. We don't actually have to reconnect because it does it automatically. Pretty impressive, actually. Well, I called Verizon a few months ago, and they asked me to check the frequency band for our wireless phones. And sure enough, they were all at 5.8 gigahertz, which means they're likely interrupting the 5 gigahertz band of our wireless router. I did have to confess to them that I had circumvented their router and was using my Airport Extreme to provide wireless and wired DHCP across to my network. They didn't freak out, which was good, but they didn't really offer a solution other than get rid of your phones. Now, just replacing them didn't seem smart, because without isolating the problem, how would I be sure that we were actually solving it? This week, Steve and I started noodling the problem. We have two base station units in the house, one downstairs in the kitchen, actually there's three, one downstairs in the kitchen that talks to the downstairs phones, one upstairs right next to my wireless router in my office that controls the phone in Steve's office. In addition, the third base station unit is sitting in one of the upstairs bedrooms, only servicing itself. To do our experiments, we have to make the phone ring. This introduces another problem. We can't use the home phones because they're part of the problem, right? We have to use a cell phone. But our cell phones rely on our AT&T microcell to get a good signal inside the house. That meant we had to turn off Wi-Fi on our cell phones to make the call to be sure we had a good test and hope that we could squeak a phone call out, even though AT&T tries to keep us from using it in our house. Now, we also needed a reliable way to tell if the network was getting interrupted. It's hard to notice if you're just surfing the net or reading email. Even watching a video online isn't a good test because they buffer up. They might not even indicate an interruption. Well, remember last week when we talked about using screen sharing to see if the Mac Mini as it runs our Drobo to Drobo backups? It turns out if the phone rings, that screen sharing connection gets dropped, and we see a connecting message with a giant spinning wheel on screen. This also provided another piece of information. It's not just that we're getting disconnected from the internet when the phone rings. Our Wi-Fi is completely stopped for those few seconds. In fact, I wonder whether we're actually being interrupted otherwise now that I think about it. Anyway, because screen sharing is on our intranet and not externally facing, we know that we're getting disconnected from Wi-Fi locally. Very interesting. Now that we have a reliable way to measure whether the Wi-Fi has been stopped, we can start changing things. To do controlled experiments, you have to change one thing at a time and then retest, or you'll never know which of your changes fixed the problem. Steve suggested that perhaps the phone base station right next to the wireless router was the problem. So our first test was to swap the base station into Steve's office, putting the satellite phone in my office. Steve rang our home line from his cell phone while I watched my screen share to the Mac Mini. And again, we were disconnected. So that eliminated the proximity of the base station to the wireless router as the root cause. Next, he suggested maybe it's the fact that we've even got the phones upstairs at all that's the problem. Or perhaps it's the phone system itself that's flawed in the way it's handling the signal. We unplugged both the upstairs base station and satellite phone and rang the house again. And again, my screen share was interrupted. So the one that was sitting by my computer and the one in his office are connected. We disconnected those. Again, my screen share is interrupted. The good news is this meant that it's not the upstairs phone system, so replacing that would have been a waste of money, which is what they told us to do. Now Steve suggested we unplug the base station and units downstairs. We both sort of groaned because the base station is mounted to the wall and it's kind of a hassle to disconnect. But then I remembered that we did have that third base station in the spare bedroom. That room was pretty old, so maybe it was created before proper shielding was implemented in phones. Plus, as I told Steve, let's test that one first because I want it to be the root cause because it's kind of cruddy. Not very engineering discipline of me to say that, but hey, sometimes emotion gets into the middle of this. But at least we still followed our scientific process, even though I knew what I wanted the answer to be. We unplugged the third base unit, rang the phone, and my screen share stayed connected. Off that phone goes to Goodwill, and we won't even replace it because what self-respecting guest would need to use a landline in a bedroom anyway? The bottom line is that by doing controlled experiments, we were able to determine the root cause of a network-based problem. Had we flung around unplugging random devices, buying new devices, not paying any attention to how the cell phone was connected, or like I said, just buying new equipment, we never would have found out the root cause. Again, I do believe non-engineering trained people can learn to do this, but it's ingrained in our whole way of thinking over at Shea Sheridan. When my daughter Lindsay got her new iPhone 6, somehow she lost all of her saved voicemails. Even though everything else came over, her saved voicemails did not come to her new phone. Now, there weren't anything that she couldn't live without, but she'd saved a few cute ones, like the one from me when I found out she was engaged. She asked me if there was any way to get them back. Now, I knew there were some paid-for tools, like I think PhoneView will do that. They can dig into your phone and into your backups, but she's on a shoestring budget. She's bought her own home, she's working on the wedding plan, so the cost was a little too steep to recommend for her. I started digging around to look for a way to get this done for free, and I found a guy named Mike Reyes who had figured it out. He did a blog post on it, and he explained that the audio files are GSM files, but you need to yank them out and turn them into .AMR files, which are adaptive multi-rate audio. His site did the whole thing in a nice terminal command, but for the unfamiliar with the terminal, it was pretty hard to follow. I mean, I was able to get it to work, but it was I was putting a whole lot of faith into it, and he didn't give a lot of explanation around it. So I whipped open Clarify, I went through his steps, I slowly took screenshots along the way, adding description to explain how all of this worked and why you were supposed to do each step. I drew one arrow and added one text callout, and I was done. I hit the WordPress icon in the menu bar on Clarify, and it posted it directly to podfeed.com as one of my tutorial pages. Just like that, and I'm done, and Lindsay was able to follow my instructions pretty much without any help from me. I love that in a few minutes I can help my family and friends to do things they could have never done before, and I know the questions that come back to me will be minimized. You should hop on over to clarify-it.com and download the free trial so you too can become a hero. Check out the tutorial link in the show notes so you can see how to get your voicemails out of backup without spending a dime. And I do give credit to Mike Reyes because he's the one who actually did figure this out. It's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond, and I am super excited to invite to the show for the first time Renee Ritchie. He is the editor-in-chief at iMore, executive producer and podcast host of Mobile Nations. He's a cook, a grappler, and a photon wrangler, and he also represents all of Canada in the field of technology, right?
I don't know. I think Jim Dalrymple and his beard get the eastern half, and I'm sort of stuck in the middle.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, the central region then.
That, yes.
That looked good. Well, I've only gotten to know you recently and really getting a lot out of the stuff you're doing at iMore. You guys have been just on a tear about the iPhone 6 and iOS 8 and all that, right?
Oh, thank you so much. And it's nice to talk to you outside of Mac break so we don't have to talk over Leo's head the whole time.
Yeah, it's like, can't see you. We did briefly meet at the Smile Party at Macworld a couple of years ago.
Absolutely.
That's about it. So yeah, this is a little more personal here. I wanted to have you on because it seems like you know a lot of the nichier, smaller pieces of what's going on in iOS 8. You know, we all saw the great new flat experience with iOS 7, but not much change under the hood. Now we kind of have the opposite experience, right?
Yeah, so iOS 7 was all about creating a new design language, and they redid every pixel on in every screen of that operating system, which was a tremendous effort. But it was mostly the way it was mostly how you relate to the software, how what it looks like, and you know, and the interactions that it presents with you, like the physics engine and the particle engine, and all the underpinnings they put into that. But iOS 8 is all about the functionality; it's how you do the things that you do, and that makes it really interesting.
I think there's good and bad to that. In iOS 8, it doesn't look very different. So if you're not paying attention, you're not going to find out about these new things you can do, right?
Yeah, and that's this very strange dichotomy, because a lot of people believe that a visual makeover, like a paint job, so to speak, is superficial. They don't want to pay for a new app just because it gets a new design, for example. Right. But at the same time, when you get deep changes to an operating system or an app, people can't see anything, so they don't think that has value either.
So they need to paint it and underpinning at the same time to get our attention, right?
Yeah.
Right. So I had a couple of things, but I think you probably know about a lot more things than I know about. I've read about things and I heard about things ahead of time, and I don't actually necessarily know how to make them all go. Like, so widgets.
Okay.
What are widgets? What do they mean to me? How do I get to them? I need some. I'm sure of it.
Everybody needs a few widgets. So there's a larger story going on with the widgets, which is called extensibility. And what Apple's done is over the last few years, they've created these technologies. One was XPC, their cross communications protocol. And they brought that over from the Mac to iOS. I think that was in iOS 6. And then they split the windowing system for the iPhone was always Springboard. That's the home screen system. And they split that into Springboard to do all the foreground tasks and Backboard to do all the background tasks. And now they have this daemon that runs as well. And that means that you can do things like widgets and like interactive notifications and like sharing extensions in a very secure and private way. And widgets is a great example of that. You now have the notification center the same way you always had it in iOS 7 going back to iOS 5. You pull it down. And previously, Apple showed you things like today, like your calendar, like your stocks, like the weather, like traffic.
That's all
sometimes.
I have now. So that's why I don't get yet.
So now if you can download apps from the App Store the same as always, but developers have the opportunity or the option of making widgets. And what widgets is basically a remote view. It's a way of taking their interface and their functionality and separating it from the app so that it can be shown in other parts of the system or in other apps. Oh. So for widgets, it lets part of the app be shown, a part of the interface and part of the functionality be shown inside the Today View section of Notification Center. And because the operating system is the one doing it, the apps never actually talk to each other. They ask something from the system goes and fetches it. It's all very private, it's all very secure. And the other advantage is, and I'm using Facebook as an example because they deserve it, if you have a Facebook widget and you're busy using it and the actual Facebook app is being a memory hog in the background and the Jetson process kills it, your interaction in the widget or in the notification doesn't go away because it's being run separately and independently.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of interesting. So how are we supposed to know if there's going to be a widget available? Is that just the surprise?
It's at the prize at the bottom of the Cracker Jack box, essentially. If you go to the Notification Center and you go to the Today View, at the very bottom now, there's a button called Edit. And when you tap on that button, you get taken to a management screen. All the settings that used to be in the Settings app are now in that management screen. And you'll see all the widgets that are currently active, and you'll see the ones that aren't. And those are usually the app ones you've downloaded, like Dropbox or pCalc or any of a dozen other little widgets that can live in there.
I don't have an edit button. I'm looking at the Today View. I've got my calendar. It says it's sunny and boiling outside at 90 degrees. It gives me my calendar, shows me some stocks I don't care about, says tomorrow, and then some stuff in gray text.
Yeah, so the things at the bottom, you should see a gray sort of edit button just at the...
Yeah, I should. Renee and I are showing each other our phones on video here. I don't have an edit button. Could that
That's
be because
appalling.
I don't have any?
It could be that you haven't downloaded any apps that have them, but there's a lot of apps that do have widgets now.
And you said Dropbox was one of them, right?
Yes.
Let me verify if I've got Dropbox down, because I do have Dropbox.
You can see in mine, it's got a list of all the recently updated Dropbox files.
Yeah. No, I... Is that something you turn on in an app, maybe?
In settings, I think it's just on now. I think they moved it all out of there.
I don't have a paid-for Dropbox account.
That shouldn't matter. As long as you have the app installed, it should just let you do it.
Link a computer upgrade account. Well, this would explain why I'm not having any fun with it.
No. I would suggest maybe a reboot, or I don't think you'd have to reinstall iOS 8, but just a reboot might.
I did a clean install on this phone because the first one I got had a real interesting problem with the screen was non-responsive. Like I couldn't type certain characters like capital letters, which was really a pain because my password had capital letters in it. But Apple swapped it out for me, and that time I did a full clean install. So there's nothing too creepy on here.
I will research this and find out why, because you should absolutely have that button. This is being denied. You're being denied your lawful right to widgets.
So maybe people are starting to collect sites where they say, here's all the apps that have widgets now. Is that a thing?
Yeah, we did a best of widgets. I find that with the problem with the app stores, there's just so many things that it becomes, if you try to catalog all of them, you become no better a solution than the app store itself.
Right.
So we try to curate that. The nice thing about widgets aren't new. The original Mac had a little calculator widget on the screen. They've just sort of transformed over time. Apple did Dashboard that had widgets in a separate window on OS X. And then Android and Nokia, they started putting widgets on the home screen. But Apple doesn't believe the home screen is a destination. They think it's a transit. They don't want you to linger there. They want you to get into apps. And the other thing is, if it's in the home screen, it's really not much better than being in an app. So having them in notification center means no matter where you are, the lock screen, the home screen, inside another app, you can just quickly swipe down and get this glanceable information no matter where you are. So it's part of this whole trend of taking interface from being this pull thing where you're always chasing after, you're always having to go somewhere to find what you want, and sort of bringing it to wherever you are now. It's like the birth of push interface.
I like it. I did put a link in the show notes. I found your article on best apps, notification center widgets. If I ever get the edit button, that'll be cool. This is what I was really hoping for, is that you know why they're doing it the way they're doing it, as opposed to just, oh, look, this is cool. This is pretty. Click this. That's very cool.
Well, they took their time and really thought about it before they implemented it.
Yeah, and you do mention over and over the security model, right? That they keep things separated from each other so they can't be sending Facebook to your bank.
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. So, for example, let's say you're browsing Facebook and an iMessage comes in and you want to answer it. You should never have to worry that the Facebook apps get to see what you're typing into iMessage. That should always be personal and private to you. Conversely, if you're in the Photos app and you're bringing in a VSCO cam or Waterlog filter, you should never have to worry that the filter that you're using gets to see the picture that you're editing. All of that should be, like, the functionality should never care about the content that you're creating in it. So this is what lets them do, like, present that functionality without ever letting them sort of cross-contaminate each other.
Okay, very cool. I talked on the show a little while ago. I signed up for a service with my medical provider where I could get online access to my medical records, which turned out to be a really good thing because they thought I was in stage 3 kidney failure, which was a mystery. I wrote to my doctor and said, did I miss a test in here somewhere? But anyway, the real comedy was when I signed up for it, they offered to let me log in with my Facebook login. That would be no. I don't care if you tell me it's secure. I'm not going to do that. So.
Well, it's really important because, worst case scenario, let's say someone ever does figure out a way to get a virus, like tricks you into downloading a malware app. You don't want that app to break out of the sandbox and get into other apps and get into the system. So this preserves the sandbox that iOS was built on, but lets some of the functionality out. And conversely, for things like Apple's health app, they're really cognizant of your privacy. So, for example, if let's say you have diabetes and you decide to use the glucose monitoring, but you turn it off for your health insurance app, it doesn't even tell them that you turned it off because that's leaking your information. Then they'll be suspicious. Why did you turn off glucose? Do you have an unreported condition? It's just invisible to them.
Oh, interesting.
And it's all part of this idea that our data is our data and it's no other app's business what we're doing.
That's very cool. So when we're impatient, when Apple doesn't roll out, cool new things like keyboards, it helps to keep in mind that there's a reason behind where they're working out how to do it without hurting us.
So, there's two ways to look at it. One way, so for example, and Siri is just an easy example to use. It's off topic, but it's easy. Apple could do with Siri what Google's doing with Google now, and that is operating on your data on the server to present you with preemptive notifications. Like they'll scan your email and say, oh, you have a flight reservation. They'll scan your location and say, this is your traffic. You should leave now. And based on the websites that I know that you visited, I'm going to recommend that you stop off and get this stuff on your way. And Google believes that you're an adult, you can make your own decisions about using it or not, and that they're giving it to you for free in exchange for that data, so you're making an informed bargain. Where Apple's point of view is they want no part of that. They don't want the responsibility of having your data on their server. So they're willing to give up that functionality. And keyboards is another great example. Google sort of, they were never as elegant as Apple, but they were way more functional because they would just enable things. And it did give you the risk of, you know, fake keyboards or keyloggers or things that didn't respect your privacy, but you had them much earlier. So again, if you consider, like, I'm an adult, I can make my own decisions, I'm computer savvy, I can recompile the Linux kernel if I want to. Mm-hmm. You know, you like that sort of freedom. You don't want a big brother sitting over your shoulder telling you what you can and can't do. But for most people, for mainstream people, they don't have the technical knowledge, I don't believe, to make informed decisions about what all that means to their data and their privacy and their functionality. And Apple creates a really safe environment where they can use it in a safe way. And maybe they have to wait longer, but they'll get a way that protects them better in the long run.
I think the important word you used about Google saying you have informed consent, I don't know that that's really true. I don't think the normal person thinks about it, that I've traded my privacy for this functionality.
Well, it's so their version of it is that you're an adult and it's your job to inform yourself and then make a decision. Where Apple's belief is that this is complicated stuff, and you know, it reminds me of one of my favorite lines from The West Wing when they had this big debate about nuclear disarmament, and he said, you know, the people in your state believe this, and he said, oh, the people in my state are in no way informed enough about the subtleties and nuances of nuclear disarmament to make a decision. I'm not either. That's why we have experts. And that Apple really believes that yes, it's your stuff, you should be able to do what you want with it, but it's really technical, deep stuff, and that not everybody is going to take the time to do that. So they want to maybe protect you a little bit again, like from yourself as well.
And I know a lot of people say that's, you know, maybe that's paranoid or that's assuming we're idiots or something. But I mean, I'm really, really into this stuff. I live and breathe this stuff, and there's a whole lot of it I don't understand.
It's manifested with the iPad. I think the iPad is a really great example of that, because I have people in my family that for whom the iPad is the greatest computer that was ever invented. It's not that they can do more with the iPad than they can with a Mac, not because the iPad can do more, but because the way the iPad is built lets them do more. Like, for example, they never have to worry that I used to get a call and say, my web browser, the internet is gone because the web browser was behind Word and they just couldn't find it. And I've told the story before, but I think it's really telling. And with the iPad, it's you press the home button, you press an app, you press a home button. And to people who are familiar with computers, that's a little bit infantilizing. But to people for whom computers were inaccessible and alien and intimidating, it's absolutely liberating. And everyone who, like, as soon as the iPad came out, Android and Microsoft, and everyone said, oh, look, Apple makes these things for kids. We're going to give you a real desktop on your tablet. And it turned out that was the last thing anybody wanted, was for people to bring the complexity of the desktop to something that they could finally understand.
Oh, yeah. I absolutely couldn't agree more. I've watched my mother-in-law. She's around 75 years old, and she's really competent on the computer. She does great. Her husband has a few more challenges in the way he attacks it. But she got an iPad, and I mean, the word love is what comes out about it. And I just got her a Bluetooth keyboard, and now she's in quadruple love. She's just – I don't think she uses her Mac anymore except when she absolutely has to. But they did something in the way they designed that kind of talks to our DNA, because you see babies and you see the elderly with Alzheimer's at both ends of the spectrum able to use it. And that's something they've gotten – they tapped into something innate in us, I think.
Well, it's direct manipulation. And so there's a really easy analog. You see something, most of the time you push it or swipe it, but you're directly interacting with what it is on the screen. And that, I think, is a very intuitive way of working with a computer. There's no intermediation with a mouse or a keyboard, unless you choose to add a keyboard to it. But you can really, like, I have this dumb saying for it, like, it's like finger painting with the computer, because you are moving. And there was this great story in the newspaper a week or so ago about this guy who didn't like Apple, and his parents had never used a computer, and his mom had vowed to never use a computer her entire life. And eventually his father got to an advanced age, and he bought an iPad, and he sort of sat there at the table just looking at it, unsure what to do with it. But eventually he opened it and he logged into it, and then by the end of the day he was FaceTiming with his daughter, and he was, wow. And his wife came over because she could see her grandchildren. Oh. And he could look at the web and get his news and do all these things, and all of a sudden he realized that it wasn't like this burden, it was this sort of enabling, empowering force in his life.
Wow. You talking about the direct interaction, there's a huge thing it solves is I have a friend that we always argue when we're working on a computer together, because to me, scroll up is like with an iPad where you push up, and, yeah, and to him, that's scroll down. So he's always saying scroll down. So I go the opposite direction. But if you're an iPad, there's no discussion, right? It's all the same direction.
Well, it's sort of like those flight simulators where, you know, people who are familiar with them know you push down to go up, you know, or pull back to go up and push down. It's something your brain has to lock into. And if you have conflicting,
it's a coordinate transformation.
Yeah, well, consistency is a user benefit. So when things all work the same, it is easier because you only have one thing to remember. It sort of reduces the cognitive load.
Yeah, yeah, and I need some help. So third-party keyboards. I've actually cracked the code on how these work, but explain how these work and what they can do. And maybe if we were talking about complexities of understanding, there's that scary question, this keyboard is going to send all your personal information to a server somewhere. What is all that?
Yeah, so a lot of this is actually Apple. I don't know if fault is the right word, but Apple did not make third-party keyboards as easy as they could have in iOS 8. So, for example, with the widgets, you just pull down Notification Center, and if you're not Allison, you have an edit button that you can press, and it's not exactly easy to find, but once someone tells you what it is, it's fairly easy to do. With keyboards, there's no hinting mechanism. If you open up a keyboard, the globe button doesn't glow to tell you there's a new keyboard available. You have to know or be told to go to settings, go to general, go to keyboards, go to keyboards, go to add new keyboard, go to third-party keyboards, add the keyboard.
Yeah, the keyboard app is actually only there to give you the instructions to go look for the keyboard, right?
Absolutely. Well, it houses the extension. Depending on the keyboard, so there's another. This, one of the scary elements about this is Apple gives keyboards very few privileges automatically. So basically, the keyboard can run inside the keyboard module, but if it's a password field, it gets turned off. If you haven't entered your passcode, it gets turned off. If you go to the phone, it gets turned off because they want to keep the carrier secure. Mm. And also, it can only operate with what's in that extension. And extensions are very small. They can't handle complex code. And if it's an emoji keyboard, you know, or a GIF keyboard, it doesn't really matter. But something like SwiftKey, which is really popular, its popularity is based on a predictive engine that learns from your typing and makes smarter and smarter and more personalized suggestions. And that's too big to fit in the keyboard. Oh. So they have to ask you to allow full access. And that's where it's scary, because full access is a generic term that means a lot of things. They're only using it so they can go back to the SwiftKey app, which is housing the brain of their software. Because it's too big to fit in the keyboard, they have to put it in the app, and the keyboard and the app have to constantly communicate.
Isn't it also storing what it's learning about what you type in online so that you can get to it from other devices?
So it's not. The allow full access is only allowing it to do the local access. It has a second option where you log in with Google Plus or Facebook, and it will then sync your options to the web and to your other devices. So if you have an iPhone, an iPad, or an iPhone and an Android phone or tablet, they'll all have the same knowledge base. But that requires you to go into their app and log into those sites. But if you just look at the allow full access dialogue, it's scary, and you don't really know what it means at the time.
Okay. Now, Apple also is learning. I mean, I know I started to type NoSilicast and it already knew the word. That's not yet an English dictionary word. So how did it – I mean, it's doing the same thing then, right? But not asking you.
Apple introduced their QuickType keyboard. When Apple first made the keyboard back in 2007, original iPhone, all it had was autocorrect, you know, of which legends now exist. Mm-hmm. But now they've added QuickType. They've added the sort of predictive stuff. But Apple is keeping it locally on the device. They're not syncing it with iCloud. So if you get a new device, the way it stands right now, you'll have to train the keyboard again. And they're doing that because they don't want you to ever have to worry about keyloggers or someone getting onto a server and finding your information. They're making sort of their differentiator be privacy and be security. And some people think that's inconvenient. They would much rather have all that stuff stored on a server so they can, you know, not have to train devices over and over again.
Right.
But that's the sort of constant tension between security and privacy. Sorry, security and convenience.
Convenience. Right, yeah. Right. So if it says, if you give it full access, it's claiming that they're now going to know everything about you and know your mother's home phone number. That's not really true, or that is true?
So Apple, it's very similar to if you have any app on the App Store that has a web browser in it. Apple makes the developer mark it as 18 and over because theoretically you could use that. Like you could use the 1Password web browser to access adult content.
Yeah. I always use 1Password to look for my porn. You know.
I'm pretty sure that's why it was built. But I mean, Apple has no way of knowing the usage, so they default to the most to the most expansive definition of what's possible. So it's the same thing with keyboards. They don't have any fine-grained way of explaining what the keyboard does. So basically, if you enable full access, this is the potential consequences of what you're doing, not specific to the app you're using. So SwiftKey is only using that for local access, but theoretically another app could be using it for online access as well.
So we don't really know, and we have to trust the app developers to not do anything bad with the data then.
Yeah, well, SwiftKey and I think Swipe and other people have very specific FAQs. Like they'll tell you exactly what they're doing and how the sync works. But yeah, you have to then go and inform yourself on an app by app basis, or just decide it's way too complicated and leave it off and do it. It's fully functional without the predictive stuff. It just doesn't learn your habits the same way.
Yeah, they do work okay without it. But yeah, that's even more fun if it starts to know your words.
Yeah.
All right. So one of the things that is making me know for a fact that I'm going to have to buy a new iPad, even though I've got an iPad Air, is that now I can't live without Touch ID. Because I just got my first iPhone with Touch ID, and the fact that Touch ID works with 1Password and LastPass, it's transformed my life.
I said this last October when I was reviewing the iPad Air, but it now takes me 10 seconds to unlock an iPad because I put my finger on it and it takes about 5 or 6 seconds to realize it doesn't have Touch ID every time and then to type in my passcode like an animal. It's just they didn't have enough Touch ID sensors last year. I mean, people at Apple want Touch ID on the iPad as much as anybody else, but they could not make sensors enough to deal with the iPhone 5S demand. So this year, hopefully, we'll get those. In a week or two.
I mean, I used to default to the iPad. If I had both nearby, I'd go to the iPad because it's so much easier to type on the big keyboard and that kind of thing. And now I'll just go, drop it and pick up my phone. I would rather look at a teeny tiny little screen than deal with typing in that password. It's just too hard now.
It's a 1Password in general has spoiled me with iOS 8 because you can unlock 1Password with the Touch ID, but you can also, when anything that has a share button, whether it's Safari or any app, you hit that share button, you hit the action extension for 1Password, and you can use it to fill in your passwords in the app, in Safari, everywhere. It's nice.
Yeah, so let's talk specifically about how that works. They call it Share Sheets, which I think is the stupidest name because it doesn't mean anything, but when you're in the example I've been using is I go in Safari to Facebook, and I start at the Facebook login screen. There's a button that's a square with a little arrow above it. That's what we're talking about. You hit that, you scroll over to the right a little bit, and you'll see 1Password or LastPass, and then you can use your thumb to authenticate. It gives you a thing and it says, do you want to use this one? You say yes, and you're done. Transformative.
Sort of, yeah. You're describing it accurately, provided you set it up properly, which again is not as because you have to first do exactly what you said, then hit the three dots icon, then turn 1Password or LastPass on in the action sheet. Right. Then it will present itself to you. But also within, I haven't used LastPass, but it might be the same. Within 1Password, you have to go and enable Touch ID, and then say I want to use Touch ID all the time, so I set master passwords every 30 days. I think.
Yeah,
I
don't, if you don't set, it's the weirdest thing. That sounds like you're going to stay logged in for 30 days, but it doesn't really mean that. It's if you don't use 1Password for 30 days, it'll lock it and not allow it. And I had to have AgileBits tell me that. I was like, why would I set it to 30 days? I want to log it out in like 15 minutes. He said, oh no, it doesn't mean that.
Yeah, so there, as far as I know, they're working on making that a little clearer just with all the new technology. But and also you have to let Keychain remember your master password so that they can reuse it every time you use Touch ID. Otherwise, it'll ask you.
I don't think I did that because I remember – let me double check. But I remember somebody saying something about that, and I'm not a big fan of the Keychain. Now I would probably allow it. The Keychain I'm talking about is the iCloud Keychain. Is that what you mean?
No. So Keychain is the internal database of passwords in iOS.
Which is not iCloud Keychain?
No. So iCloud Keychain is a service that's like 1Password that syncs keychains between devices using iCloud.
Say that one more time.
So Keychain by itself is just a password database, the same thing that's on the Mac. You have basically a Keychain database, and that remembers passwords for the things that you want them remembered for. Okay. iCloud Keychain takes that and will sync passwords that you want it to sync between your devices.
Okay. The reason I had stayed away from it, by the way, was what bothers me is I see people with phones that either have no password at all or they got a 4-digit code and they turn on iCloud Keychain, which means now only 4 digits protect your most private passwords, right?
Yeah,
I didn't think that was a really good idea.
I don't use it. I use 1Password because another example, let's say you come up to me at a trade show and you say, Renee, my phone is dead. Can I just make a quick phone call? And I'm a human being, so I'm going to give you my phone. But once it's unlocked, if I use iCloud Keychain and you were not you, but you were some, you know, malicious attacker who just looked like super friendly and super in need, you would then have access to every password for every website, including banking websites. I like that 1Password and other programs like LastPass make you put in a master password or use Touch ID to get to the passwords after the phone is unlocked.
Yeah, yeah.
So to me, that's exactly an important second step.
Now, I hope somebody proves me wrong, but I read I was a LastPass user, and I've just recently converted to 1Password. And LastPass will do what 1Password does inside Safari, where you can do the quadruple swipe thing to have it fill in a password, and it'll use your Touch ID to open that. But you can't open the vault with your thumb. Which is really strange. And I read on their site that they said, no, we don't do that. And I don't quite understand why you'll let me use it, but you won't let me go to the vault with my thumb. You have to type in your last password. It's like, well, that sounds too hard, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, what I would love is for you to be able to choose between your password, your Touch ID, or if you're a super paranoid security person, both. So then it's two-factor. Like, you got to type in the password and put your thumbprint on, so it's something you know and something you are at the same time.
Right. Well, let's stop talking about vegetables. Let's talk about the camera. So okay. I remember reading that we were going to have access to all kinds of manual functions, aperture and shutter speed and ISO and all that, but I don't see anything different in the camera app.
So the camera app only has one difference. Apple has made manual camera controls available. So what they let you do is manual focus, manual exposure, and manual white balance. But the iOS default camera app is only getting something called exposure bias. So if you swipe up or down on the screen, you can bias the exposure up or down between -8 and +8.
Okay.
So basically an f-stops.
That's the little sun
yes.
that you see. I think you have to tap on the screen first to focus, sort of. And then you get the thingy.
On the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, they have focus pixels, and it's so fast that you don't even get that little box. So as you tap to swipe to get the exposure bias, you're basically doing the same thing. You can just start swipe. As soon as you touch your finger down, it'll activate that, and then you can swipe up or down.
Okay. So where's all the other cool stuff then?
The other stuff is made available to developers. So for example, if you download the manual app from the App Store or Camera Plus or a lot of the other camera apps on the store, they are implementing all those manual controls. So Camera Plus, you can download it. You can go to settings. You can turn on manual controls. And then you have a button in each one of those settings. So manual focus, you can slide back and forth to almost like a focus ring on a camera to say, yes, I know this is the biggest, most obvious target in this photo and your algorithm is screaming for you to lock into this, but I really want that guy in the background over there. You know, I want to see what he's doing. Or you can say, yes, I know that, you know, this is low light and you're ramping up the ISO because you want this, but I'm willing to have a dark picture because I want, you know, my child to be, as Andy says, you know, tack sharp in the picture, or I don't want noise. It's like you're imposing your own judgment on top. Or if you have mixed lighting, you can control tint or temperature. So you can say, I know it's a lot of blues here, but do this. Or I know there's a lot of red purples here, so do that.
So I did download the manual app after I heard you talking about it on MacBreak Weekly. And what I found crazy, and I don't understand how they're doing, is you can also have manual focus with this thing. So I was able to do like a real tight, sharp, shallow depth of field. How is it doing that?
So the lens in the iPhone actually moves around. They have a little spring inside it that moves it. And what they're doing with this is typically the iPhone will autofocus. It'll just control that. It used to do contrast focus. Now it's doing focus pixel focusing. So it's much faster. But you're overriding that and you're saying, I know you want to do this, but I want you to move the lens this way, either forwards or backwards within the body of the iPhone.
But it's not just where it's focusing. It's also making a shallower depth of field too. When I go down towards the little flower.
Well, I mean, it's an f2.2 lens, so you can get
do that.
Yeah, as much bokeh as an f2.2 lens can deliver to you.
Wow. Now, you've mentioned focus pixels a couple of times. Can you give us a little more depth on what that means?
All right, so focus pixels in the camera means that there's dedicated pairs of pixels in the camera that basically work like little shutters. They take in the light and they determine its, what's the right word for it? I'm blanking on the word for it, but traditionally it focuses based on contrast. So basically, it moves the lens back and forth and tries to lock on focus. What this does is, and again, there's a fancy word for it, and I forget it. I'm forgetting what the word is, but it let's say you have the two focus pixels have two blurry images of the flower in them. Mm-hmm. It'll move the lens. It'll tell the lens how to move to get those to be aligned internally. Uh-huh. Because there's two pixels, it's getting two different angles of light, and it can quickly calculate what those two angles of light means in terms of getting that picture.
And it's actually manually moving the lenses to do that.
Well, so previously the lens would move back and forth until it got into focus. Now it's looking at the picture and telling it, I think it's phased focus. Is that the right word?
Phase detection.
Anyway, phase detection focus. That's
there
right.
We go.
Perfect. Yeah. It's doing phase detection. So it says, this is what I'm seeing, and this is how you have to move to make this sharp.
So contrast detection would be looking for the edges of things.
Yes.
Phase detection is measuring the light that goes out and comes back to two different spots.
Yes.
And says, okay, these things are out of phase, and therefore that is an edge, and I should focus on that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
So it's like what a DSLR has.
Right. I think I went backwards with my mirrorless camera. I think it's actually contrast detection, but I didn't pay for the big one. So,
yeah, but it just means that in most cases, like with an iPhone 6 or iPhone 6 Plus, the focus is near instant.
Yeah, it is really, really fast.
And the side benefit is because it has focus pixels, it can now do continuous focus in video, which it couldn't do previously.
Huh.
So you can have a close-up, and then so for example, if you're doing a sweep and you have someone in the foreground and you have more people in the background, previously it would have to pick one or the other, and you'd have a blurry person in the foreground or blurry people in the background. Now it'll register the person in the foreground, focus on them, and then as you're moving, it'll refocus on the people in the background. And if you go back, it'll focus again. So video stays in focus as you're moving.
I got to play with the camera some more.
It's phenomenal.
So now, photos. I remember them saying that in the old days, we would have an app like Snapseed. We would have to go get a photo out of the photo library, give it permission to talk to the photo library, get it, add filters to crop and everything, and then have to put it back. And then you ended up with two copies. That was supposed to be all solved now.
Yeah, well, that's the biggest fundamental change about iOS 8, and it's because of extensibility. Is previously with everything, for example, if you wanted to share something with Pinterest, you'd have to go to the web, copy the link, go back to Pinterest, copy it into Pinterest, then share it from there, or use the built-in browser in Pinterest. You couldn't do it from where you were. If you wanted to use 1Password, you had to go to 1Password, copy the password, or use the embedded browser in 1Password. All of these things meant that your workflow had to involve you running around all over the iPhone or iPad to do it. Now all that stuff comes to you. So like you said, you can just use 1Password within the app. And photos is the same thing. Previously, you take the photo, and Sarah Lane did a great demo. This was 6 different photo apps, I think. You take the photo, you'd leave the Photos app, you'd go to VSCO Cam, load the photo in, make your filters, save it, go out, go into Snapseed, make your edit, save it, go out, go into Photoshop, you know, touch, make your edits, save it. You have all these copies of these images just piling up. So what Apple's done now is using the same extensibility framework, the apps, the photo apps can define their filters and their transformations, and then they can send them right to the Photos app. So you take your photo, you tap the little thumbnail, you go into the Photos app, you hit the edit button, you have the same tools you used to have before, like red eye removal and the magic wand, and you also have Apple's new quasi iPhoto, quasi Lightroom style, sorry, quasi aperture style controls for color and black and white and the rest. But you can also press another button and it brings up whatever apps you have installed that have filters or effects. And you tap those and you can apply them within the Photos app.
Oh, you bring them up from within the Photos app.
Yeah.
So within, wait a minute.
Apple's Photo app.
So I'm starting to get confused again because I take a picture with the camera. And I've got edit capabilities right then. So am I in the camera app or am I in the Photos app at that point?
They blur because whenever you take a photo, a little thumbnail, that photo is in the bottom left side.
Right.
And when you tap on that, you get a quick version of the Photos app.
But that's not the real Photos app?
I mean, you can move into it if you tap see more photos. It's a little bit of a blurry line.
Okay.
So for the sake of simplicity, let's say you're in the Photos app. You took 10 photos. You left there. You went to the Photos app.
Okay. Okay, good.
You hit edit, and then you have the little dot, dot, dot icons again. And
right.
You tap on those, and that'll show you any filters that are available to you. And the coolest thing is they've developed this – they have this system of non-destructive edits now. So everything is saved. Previously, if you did those 6 steps in 6 different apps and you decided step number 2 wasn't right, your only choice was to do everything all over again. Now you can just go back to the filter and change that one change, and it'll what's the right way of putting it? It'll just adjust the changes from that filter. You won't have to go back and redo everything again. It's all non-destructive edits.
Oh, nice. That is really nice. So do apps have to write to be able to connect into that extensibility?
Yes. Yeah.
So that'll be another case of where we have to watch that you may have an app that doesn't.
Yeah, so and it depends. Usually, like, the bigger the company is, the longer it takes them to do it for some reason.
Well, now Snapseed's owned by Google. Does Snapseed do it? Because that's one of the big boys, right?
I haven't looked at Snapseed yet, but they got John Knack now, so I'm confident in their abilities.
Oh, who's he?
John Knack used to be the guy who ran Photoshop and then ran mobile at Adobe, and he went over to Google.
Oh, okay. Never underestimate the power of a bureaucracy to keep things from getting done, though.
No, but I mean, it'll take time because, like, eventually, like, it's an interesting bargain because Apple is asking developers to let them basically take over the functionality of their apps. And some developers, especially big brands, want to maintain their own sort of relationship with their user. Mm-hmm. So the concession Apple is making is you can use default iOS interface if you want to, or you can make your own interface and they'll pull that along. So it'll look like you're in Instagram, or it'll look like you're in VS Code Cam, or it'll look like you're in Snapseed. And they're hoping that provides enough of a user experience that the manufacturers or the developers will be confident in letting Apple present their functionality.
I find that very interesting because when you deal with norms, they often really don't know what they're in. I mean, a friend of mine was navigating for a trip we were on, and I asked her, I said, which app are you? And she goes, well, the one that tells me how to get there. And I said, oh, Apple Maps. She goes, well, I don't know. Okay. Probably Apple Maps. So, of course, we made sure we got Google Maps and Waves going at the same time, so they all gave us conflicting instructions. But but I don't think people often understand where they are, so I can see why they would want to try to maintain that relationship with their customers.
Well, and also if you sort of have an affinity for a certain app, like you just love this app, it makes you feel confident. And if a bland sort of standard book interface comes up, you might be worried that you're not where you think you are.
Yeah.
And if it looks like the app you're familiar with, at least there's a visual cue that you are where you think you are.
Yeah. So I want to switch gears a little bit. In your review, your long, exhaustive reviews, if you guys want to know everything about the iPhone and iPhone 6 Plus, the 6 and 6 Plus, great reviews, great videos. I was a little disturbed that you guys got rainwater on one of the phones at one point. That was kind of upsetting, but great reviews over at iMore.com. You talked about the dual IPS display. Now walk us through what that means.
So Apple's been using IPS displays for a long time, and that just means in-plane switching. And it's a technology that allowed you to have better field of vision. So if people weren't facing directly on the screen, if they were next to you and looking at an angle, it would still look good. And it's easy to tell when you don't have technology like that. For example, on airplane displays, if you're like a few inches to one side, the screen looks reversed.
Yeah.
That's never what you want. So IPS, they did that in the Mac, they did that in the iPhones and the iPads. It makes a very good-looking, very good display. They're taking it up a notch with the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, and they're using what's called dual domain pixels. So in a standard display, in a regular IPS display, you have red, green, and blue pixels. Each pixel is made up of a red, green, or blue subpixel. And they turn those on at different intensities to make every other color imaginable. So if it's just the blue on, it looks blue. If it's just the red on, it looks red. If it's red and blue, it looks, you know, purple. Green.
Yeah. Oh, no, that one's purple.
Yeah, so and then you control the intensity of that. It makes lighter or darker or more blue or more red, purple. So those three subpixels do all that work. And that's fine if you're looking straight at it. But when you're looking at an angle, you can sometimes get some color shift or lack of contrast. So what dual domain does is it skews the pixels. So instead of them all being straight, one row of pixels will slant upwards and the other row will slant downwards. And that just means that when you're looking at it from an angle, there's more of a chance half of those pixels are biased towards you.
Oh.
And when you're looking at it from the other angle, the other pixels are biased towards the other person. When you're looking straight on, it makes no change because you're looking top down.
Okay.
But from the sides, there's just a little bit of hinting in both directions. And that means you get better, more consistent color and better contrast. Text looks crisper. Reds and purples come through nicer.
So this is really for sharing the screen, for looking off angle, for showing other people photos of your idiot kids or your stupid dog or whatever.
Well, yeah, because the screens are bigger now. So one of the things when you have bigger screens is you tend to share them more often. If it's a tiny little iPhone and you want to show someone else a video, it's hard. You probably just hand them the phone. But if you have a big screen, like the iPhone 6 Plus is 5.5 inches, you might legitimately be sitting there with two friends next to you watching a video or looking at a web page or a Facebook status or something.
Sure. Yeah. So when you started talking about pixels and points and stuff on one of the shows recently, this is kind of, I'm kind of skidding sideways into a completely different topic, but it's sort of related. You were talking about the difference on one of the shows between pixels and points and resolution, and as that related to the size of targets for your fingers on screen. And I sort of started to understand it, but I wanted you to go through that because I don't completely get it.
I should point out that with all of this stuff, I know just enough to be dangerous about it. Like I'm not an optical engineer. I'm not like a screen tech. I'm not a developer. So
you're
I only know enough.
Photon Wrangler, though.
Yeah, well, I my background is in design, so I can sometimes explain that a little bit better than the other stuff. But I'm giving you sort of my understanding of it based on watching, you know, and reading a ton of stuff. But I'm by no means like an expert in each of these fields. But my understanding of all this stuff is the original iPhone was 320 by 480, and one pixel equaled 1 point. And Apple very early on decided that 44 points or 44 pixels back then was a big enough target that most people could hit it reliably most of the time.
Okay.
If you make something smaller, the smaller and further away a target is, the harder it is to hit it. The closer and bigger it is, the easier it is to hit it.
Right.
So you can make something far away and super big or close and smaller, and all these things are fine. But you always want to have a target that if someone jabs a finger at it, they have a reasonable chance of hitting it because otherwise they get frustrated.
Right, right.
So Apple decided 44 points on an iPhone was a really good target size.
But a point is not always a pixel.
No, so in the beginning it was. But then with the iPhone 4, Apple went to Retina display. And what Retina display does is it doubles the horizontal and vertical pixels. That's what makes it so sharp. So instead of 320... by 480, they went to 640 by 960.
Okay.
So, but that if they just kept the pixel, the touch target, the same size as the pixels, it'd be too small now. It'd be half the size.
Okay, let me think about that. Okay, so for every four pixels is 1 point?
Yes.
Is that correct? So if it would be half as many points if it were the same number of pixels.
So if you imagine like you had the original iPhone and then Apple doubled all the pixels but kept the interface the same size, yeah, it would. Everything would be super tiny. It'd be 1/4 the size.
That's actually what does happen on a Retina Mac screen, right? Everything just gets really small.
Well, you have the choice. The Retina Mac is a different beast. The Retina Mac is not exactly Retina because they didn't double it. They basically made the screen smaller and then doubled it, and they used a thing called a scaler to fill the screen. That's what they're doing with the iPhone 6 Plus too. But so we'll get to that in a second because that's more complicated. Yeah. So what they did is they made four pixels equal a point because that way there's four times as many pixels, but if four pixels equal a point, for a user, for someone looking at it, it's the same size.
It's just crisper.
Yeah. So instead of making it 1/4 the size, they made it take up – they cut it into four parts basically.
Okay.
So every time – used to have a 1 pixel. Now that's 4 pixels.
Okay.
So the advantage of that is if you were trying to make a circle, for example – on an original iPhone, it might look like two cross lines. You know, that's not very smooth. Mm-hmm. But on the Retina display, because each of those would be, you know, made up of 4 pixels, you could start to smooth that out. So it would look more like a circle.
Sure.
Now what they've done with the iPhone 6 is they've gotten, the iPhone 6 Plus, sorry, is they're rendering things at 3x, which means that there's 3 pixels in vertically and horizontally for every point.
Okay. So it's triple the resolution of the original iPhone?
Yes.
Okay. So it's, okay. Got you.
So I forget that number is 22-something by – it's anyway, really big numbers.
We used to know them all by heart. Right?
There's so many now.
Okay.
So what they're doing, they're doing that. But because they can't make a display that dense yet, they're downsampling it to 1080p. So basically you're getting 1920 by 1080. So internally, they're rendering it at 3x, and then they're scaling it down to fit the screen, which is the same thing they're doing on the
really
Retina Max.
That's really confusing. What does that mean to me as a user if I'm looking at it?
Almost nothing. So all it means is that the things that like a button is a button is a button. If you put three iPhones next to each other, you'll notice a little bit of difference. For example, the iPhone 6 can have more icons than the iPhone 5 because it's more real estate.
Right.
And just like the iPhone 5 could have more icons than the iPhone 4S because it was taller.
Right.
So, but what it means is on the iPhone 6, nothing really changes. They just added more pixels. It's the same density. It's the same 2x scaling factor. There's just more on top, more on the sides, more on the bottom.
Okay, but I didn't get an extra column too, did I? I got an extra row.
On the bottom you did. There's enough to give you an extra row of icons.
Okay,
on the
so
home
are
screen.
They just spread out a little more in width?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So, yeah. So you
but
have,
then on
you,
the 6 Plus, what did they do?
On the 6 Plus, they did the same thing, but... So let me explain one other thing because it'll make more sense in a second.
Okay.
They've got this thing called Display Zoom on the iPhone 6s. So if they have to solve two different problems. One problem is there's always been people who wanted more pixels because they could do more things. They wanted to see more web pages, read more lines of text. Those are the people who have great eyesight and they just want more of what they had.
I hate those people.
Then you, yeah, me too. Then you had people who didn't have such great sight and they just wanted everything to be bigger. They wanted bigger graphics and bigger text. So Apple's trying to answer both those people with the iPhone 6. In regular mode, you just get more pixels. So you can see more characters per line, more lines per page, more icons per page, more of everything, more content. If you put it in display mode, the iPhone 6 takes the iPhone 5 screen and zooms it up, magnifies it. The iPhone 6 Plus takes the iPhone 6 screen and magnifies it. So you don't get anything more. You get no more pixels, no more text, no more graphics, but everything is bigger. It's like it's magnified.
Are the
so
targets
it's easier
bigger?
To read. Yes, everything's
is bigger. It's just yes. zoomed up.
Okay. Yeah, it's exactly zoomed. So if you have visual impairment or motor impairment or physical impairment, it just makes it easier to use.
Okay.
So those are the two choices you're having. If you keep it in the same mode, the touch targets are about the same size. Apple sort of doesn't want us to worry about those sort of things. They make the developers do the hard work there. Like the developers have to account for the new screen sizes, but once they do for us, it really should just work. So if a developer hasn't updated an app, it'll look like that zoomed in effect. Everything will just look super big because they're scaling it up. But if they do update their app, then you have the choice of using the new interface, and that means you'll get like more lines in your more statuses in your Twitter app.
Do they have to write separate versions for every different screen size? Or did Apple put some hooks in to allow that to happen?
So what they did a couple things. I think it was a year or two ago, they moved over something called auto layout, which is a marketing term. It's really constraint-based layout. Now, it doesn't work the way responsive web design does, but the effect is pretty similar. So previously, because there was only very few iPhone sizes, developers could essentially paint pixels everywhere they wanted them to be. They could make what's called pixel perfect design. So they would take a screen and say, this is the screen and I'll make each individual pixel look exactly the way I want it.
Okay.
But that only works if you have very few targets because it's too expensive in terms of time and effort to do that for 100 different screens. So what Apple did is they brought auto layout over. So that's a constraint-based system. So you could say, I want these buttons to be grouped together and I want them to stay close to the left-hand corner. So then if the screen gets bigger, they'll still stay close to the left-hand corner. The developer doesn't have to redraw them. They just know to be there, or they need to know to be at the bottom right-hand corner.
So that's probably the way it works on a Mac screen, right? Because you got all different screen resolutions?
Well, the Mac actually just fills as much area as they have. So the Mac, if you have a big screen or a small screen, things don't really move around. They sort of stay where they are relative to the left top 0, 0 coordinate. You'll just get more towards the bottom right as you go on.
Well, but like if I'm looking at my Skype window right now, the three buttons, the red, green, and yellow buttons will always be clustered on the left, and the search box
absolutely.
Will always be on the right, kind of like
but
that.
But at a certain, like if you start stretching it out, it kind of stretches, but at a certain point it stops.
Yeah.
And then you have large amounts of white space.
Okay.
So what they did this other thing with iOS this year, which is called size classes. So basically, everything gets a size class now, and they're kind of confusing. But for example, an iPhone is compact, and an iPad is regular. And you have vertical. Well, I mean, developers have a lot to deal with now. They have different screen sizes, different screen densities. They have landscape and portrait orientation, and then there's some other complications. But these are a lot of factors. So what you can do, for example, is say you can make a default layout and say I have these four buttons stacked one on top of the other. But then if I rotate to landscape, that doesn't make sense anymore because now I'm wide, I'm not tall. Right. So I'm going to take these and make a grid of 4x4 and they're going to arrange this way. So once they define that, as soon as you rotate, the system will just animate the buttons into the new position.
Oh, okay. And that auto layout thing does it for you?
Auto layout and size classes, yeah. Apple calls it adaptive UI.
Now, I assume Android had to figure this out a long time ago.
Yeah, they use a bunch of systems, and I'm going to get it wrong because I don't remember enough about Android, but they have fragments, and they have – the Nexus 7 was a bit of a hack because it originally took some part of the phone interface and some part of the tablet interface. Right. But Android's always been good about this because they've had always a wide variety of sizes to fit. Apple sort of is doing something similar but in a very Apple way.
Okay.
And the really cool thing is with the iPhone 6 – actually, developers can do this with any app, but because the iPhones are 16x9 now, Apple's bringing what's called a split view controller to the iPhone. That's the way. So on the iPhone traditionally has been a one column device. You get a list, you tap on that list, you get the details of whatever that item is. So if I have Allison in my contacts, all I see is a list of contacts. I tap on your name, it goes to a separate screen. It sort of animates me into a new screen that shows your picture and your phone numbers and your email addresses. So that's called a detail view. So on the iPhone, you can see the list view, and then you tap it, you get the detail view. On the iPad, they could split that, and you could have the list view on one side and the detail view on the other side.
Right.
So I could see both at the same time, and I could just tap through the different lists, and I didn't have to move around the interface. It would just change the second column.
Forward and back.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Now, on the landscape on the iPhone, it's so wide that it's not really a good use of space to have one column there. They just made these super awkward-looking wide columns. So developers can now do split screens on the iPhone in landscape mode. So you can have one list like always in portrait. Then when you rotate it, it'll switch to an iPad-like app with the list on one side and the details on the other side.
Is that only on the 6 Plus?
Apple is only doing it for their apps on the 6 Plus, but developers can do it on any app from the iPhone 5 up, I believe.
Oh, okay. I think I understand that a lot better. I did want to get back to the Macs too, though. I'm still a little bit confused, and probably because I knew too much, but I was really good at understanding when I went into the display's preferences and I could say, I want my screen to be this resolution. And now it says, oh, Allison, don't worry your pretty little head about it. We'll call it fast and more and bigger.
It's like a Facebook status. It's complicated now, and that's why I'm failing a little bit to describe it properly. But so the iPhone 6 Plus is working sort of like what the Macs are doing, and that is Apple is rendering internally at a bigger size than it's displaying. So I forget what it is on the Mac.
Size being higher resolution?
Yeah. So okay. It's rendering at 3x on the iPhone 6 Plus and then scaling it down to fit 1080p. On the Mac, it's rendering at 2x and then scaling it down to fit the physical size of the display.
Okay.
Because it's doing that, you can do your own version of scaling. Like on the iPhone, it's very specific. You can do display zoom or non-display zoom. You have two choices.
Right.
On the Mac, it's giving you a variety of choices. So, for example, you can go all the way up and show as much as the internal buffer is rendering. I don't know if buffer is the right term. You can show the maximum pixels. Especially, you can show the entire thing that the Mac is rendering on the screen, but everything is super small.
Okay.
Or you can get it to scale that down to what they call ideal for Retina, and then scale it down even further if you're visually impaired and you want to make stuff bigger.
So I always feel like I'm cheating myself in some way if I go off of best Retina, but best Retina to me doesn't look like there's enough stuff on screen. And so what am I losing if I go off of best Retina? Is it less sharp?
Yeah, but I mean, so like an iPhone 6 Plus is 401 DPI, like dots per inch, which is really high densities. There are some designer friends I know who can see it. Like as you scroll, they can see the single pixel horizontal lines flickering.
Right.
It doesn't bother me at all.
That's
some people,
like
it's like nails in a chalkboard.
This guy's about MP3, right?
Absolutely. But some people notice it on the Mac because you're – so I should back up a second. Retina is both density and distance because the further away you are, the less dense it has to be to still make the pixels disappear effectively.
Okay.
It's why the iPad Air is slightly lower density than the iPad Mini, but it's so big you might hold it a little bit further away and that sort of makes up the difference.
Okay.
A Mac you typically sit across from and use the keyboard on, so it's typically even further away. So the density doesn't have to be as high. And when something is further away and it's at Retina density, if they're scaling, the anti-aliasing sort of disappears. Like you can notice it if you get in close and sort of look for it, but a normal person, normal distance, normal usage, it's almost imperceptible.
I find this whole subject fascinating because in general with computers, there are just simply facts. This one is faster than that one. This one has an SSD. This one has a hard drive. Everybody can tell. Everybody agrees on it. But when you start talking about Retina, there are people who just go out of their minds that they can't stand a non-Retina display. And I look and I go, I guess that looks better. It doesn't hit me in the face. And I am well over 40, but I'm also wearing $600 worth of eyewear right now. I'm wearing contacts and glasses to be able to see you on screen right now. So I have really, really good vision with these glasses. And I look and I go, I don't know. I'm looking at a 27-inch cinema display and a Retina MacBook Pro, and they look about the same to me. So, but other people just go out of their minds about it.
Everyone has their sort of thing that they notice, or things that are important to them, or things that they know. Like, I've watched movies with mechanics who, when a car goes over a bump, they go, oh, that's not realistic. That car would scratch the gas tank. Or, you know, an airplane has turbulence. Oh, that's not realistic. The airplane. Or a psychologist. Oh, what they're doing is terrible. That person would be scarred for. So whatever you know lets you be, like right now, I'm talking about stuff that I don't know really well. So I'm a little bit dangerous. And that's what it, like, some people will notice flicker in a single pixel line. Some people will notice, if you're a photographer, you might notice, like the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus have the full gamut of standard RGB, sRGB, which is really important to photographers. The iPad mini does not. Would a normal person notice the difference? Probably not. But if you're a photographer and you're used to color control across a wide range of devices, that's something you've trained yourself to look for. So it's going to bother you more than it would somebody else.
Interesting. It sort of sounds like they're just a bunch of big fat whiners, is what you really said there.
Well, it's like I did publishing for a long, like a design for a long time in print, and I would walk through a street and I would say, "Oh, they're using Mistral for that sign too. Can we please have something else? It's just so boring." But that's the trap you fall into when something is your profession. Like, the only way the mind can cope with it not being boring is to divide it up into so many smaller details and make those details so important that they stay interesting to you.
Interesting. I've talked about this with people who are really close to their profession, just like what you talk about. I remember many years ago taking a VCR in to get it repaired, and the guy said, "Well, now, you haven't ever used the same tape more than 5 times, have you?" I looked at him, I said, "Yeah, that tape that's in there right now, it's been taping all my children on that first hour for the last 5 years." You know? And to him, that was just, you know, it was horrifying, the idea of doing that.
You're a monster.
Or when the vet tried to convince me to brush my cat's teeth. I was like, yeah that's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
I know there are people who will. Well, this has been really cool. I bounced you all over the place, but like I was hoping, you seem to know a lot about very few things. A lot about a lot of things is what I
really mean. There might be inaccuracies in there. I think my reviews are probably, I had more time to think about it. So if I said anything wrong here, I just hopefully it's correct in there.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time on what has turned out to be an incredibly busy time for you. Appreciate you squeezing me in here.
No, my pleasure.
So why don't you plug some stuff? Where should people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Renee Ritchie, and you can find me on iMore.com. And if you want to see the podcasts I do, you can go to iMore.com/podcasts.
Oh, great, great. Yeah, you said you just had a really good version of Debug just came out?
Yeah, we had the former director of iOS apps at Apple, Nitin Ganatra, and we had the former director of internet technologies, Don Melton, on to talk about sort of what it was like to demonstrate for Steve Jobs when stuff goes wrong and why they made the choices they did about gestures and about web versus native.
That sounds wonderful.
I like that, because a lot of times people just look at Apple and there's a blank wall and they don't understand, and sometimes they can take it as hostility but they really deeply care about the choices they made, and they think about them deeply. And it's interesting to sort of see that process. Oh. Like, why didn't we have, in a previous episode, you know, why didn't we have MMS? The Apple doesn't care about it. Well, it turns out that Apple, you know, they had Safari, so they didn't bother to make a WAP browser, and you need WAP browsing for MMS, so they have to go back and make a WAP browser. And all these sort of things happen that we don't see from the outside, but sort of make you feel better when you hear them.
That sounds really good. So Debug is also listed at imore.com/podcast. Yeah.
Or imore.com/debug if you want that one specifically.
Great, great. All right. Thanks again. I really appreciate you coming on, Renee.
Thank you so much.
Man, I had such a good time with Renee. I don't know if he had fun, but I had such a great time. He's coming back whether he likes it or not. So after I got off with Renee, and by the way, I showed Renee my iPhone in the camera, so he was my witness that I did not have that edit button on the widget screen. I went to show it to Steve, and the edit button showed up. So luckily, I was able to let Renee know that he did not have that action item to go check and see why I didn't have the edit button. It was very, very weird. But anyway, man, I just had a blast. I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. Now, don't forget to send in your reviews to Bart, because he's doing the show on the 19th. So you got to get to him like 3 or 4 days. If you're going to do something, let him know and come through for Bart, because he's going to really need some help making up the show. But that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping to pay the bills. Blue Mango Learning at bluemangolearning.com. Makers of Clarify. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions. You can send Bart dumb questions, too. Comments and suggestions can come this way, too. Email me at Allison@podfeet.com. Be sure to follow me on Twitter and app.net over at Podfeet. Go check out that Google Plus community, the NoCellCast Google Plus community at podfeet.com/Google Plus. Again, having a blast over there. I've been posting stuff. George from Tulsa's always in there. We got people showing off photography, asking questions. We're having a great time. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time, just like Peter B. and Kiwi Spoon did, and Ghibli's was back, and we had Carl B. Kirkland, who hasn't been in there before. We had a blast in the live show, so you need to come on over and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways at 5 p.m. Pacific time on Sunday nights over at podfeet.com/live. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.